Welcome to episode 117 of Frank Reactions, the podcast that helps you profit from the digital era through better customer experiences online and off. My name is Tema Frank. Frank Reactions is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. And today's episode is with the man who literally wrote the book on the new rules of marketing and PR. He's actually the author of 10 books, three of which are international bestsellers, the inventor of the term newsjacking, and for those of you who like your marketing a little rough-edged, one of his books is Marketing Lessons from the Grateful Dead, which he co-authored with Brian Halligan, the CEO of HubSpot. My guest is David Meerman Scott. In today's episode, we talk about some of the risks of newsjacking and what not to do if you are trying that technique, how to own a market niche, even when it's one that seems pretty crowded, like online marketing, and why you shouldn't gate your content by demanding things like an email address before people can download something. Now, I've got to admit, I do waver on that one. Philosophically, I totally agree with him, and for years I didn't do it. But then I started to wonder if it was really possible to grow your list big enough without playing that awful game. I waver, and as I say, I go back and forth. At a minimum, I guarantee you, I will not demand your email address if you want to download this episode of Frank Reactions. Before I jump into today's show, I want to share a special opportunity with you. When I was an undergraduate student, out of a class of some 700 business students, only 12 of us wanted to take the entrepreneurship class. Well, those days have changed, but sometimes all entrepreneurs need a little more than they can get from a class. If you're based in Alberta, or are going to be here on February 20th, Alberta Women Entrepreneurs is having a learning day in Edmonton. And you, my dear listeners, get a 10% discount by using the word podcast at checkout. This one-day conference features keynotes and workshops about human resources, operations, financing, marketing, technology, and mindset. You'll learn a ton. And it's a great way to meet other entrepreneurs, so you'll feel a little less alone in your journey. Great news, it's only $99 until January 19th, and if you're listening to this after January 19th, it's still only $129 Canadian for a full day of learning. You can register at bit.ly/AWE Learning Day, and the AWE, the L in learning and the D in day are capitalized, that might matter. And remember to use the promo code podcast at checkout for your 10% discount. Now let's get right into today's episode.
Hey Tema, this is David Meerman Scott, and I am a sales, marketing, and customer support strategist. I've written 10 books, three of them are international bestsellers. I speak at events around the world, and I serve as an advisor to emerging companies.
How the heck do you find time to write 10 books?
That's my secret. When I think of something that really interests me, I can't wait to write it down. Yeah. And I explore ideas on my blog. So typically when I begin writing a book, I frequently have as much as 25% of the book done based on just grabbing blog posts and repurposing them, grabbing articles I've written for magazines and repurposing them, that kind of thing.
David, you were one of the, you and I think both got into the internet quite early in the 90s, and you were one of the early...
You're aging us, Tema.
Well, what the heck, it's the reality. And, yeah. And I think we're finally reaching a stage where experience is actually considered worthwhile. In the early days of the net, it was like I was 30-something and considered old. So I'm glad
I think there's some truth to that. I know in my case, I was really lucky because the early part of my career prior to the public internet, I worked in the financial information business, and my first job was on a bond trading desk. So I actually was able to, number one, use, and then number two, do marketing for information services and products prior to the web. So I felt like I had a 15-year head start on this whole game. Mm-hmm.
So David, you started then in the financial services industry on a desk, a trading desk. How did you end up with the focus you currently have on marketing and PR?
So it was a little circular route. I guess like many of us, I started on the bond trading desk, got fresh out of school, thought I wanted to be a bond trader. I was terrible at it, which was a good thing because that point had meant I needed to get myself into a new direction. So I then started working for companies on the other side of the screen. So I worked for a company called Wrights & Associates that was affiliated with Dow Jones. And then I worked with a company called Knight Ridder that was eventually acquired by Reuters. Mm-hmm. I worked for a company called NewsEdge that was acquired by Thomson Reuters. And these were all information-related companies where I was either in sales or marketing or both. And so the bond trading experience got me interested in financial markets. And then I started working for these information companies that served the financial markets. And then I was laid off in 2002 and had to figure out what I was going to do next. And that was that was right after 9/11. So it was a really bad job market. And by necessity, I went out on my own and started doing consulting for companies. And I found I really enjoyed it because I was able to apply the ideas that I had learned as a marketing person for these technology companies. And this was in the very early days, 02 of the of the web. And I found that I was able to do sort of things like search engine optimization before people really even focused on it, and content marketing before anyone had really named it that. And then I started writing books. I started doing magazine articles first, then writing books. My first nonfiction book came out in 2005. And then in 2007, The New Rules of Marketing and PR came out, which is the book I'm best known for. That one is now in 29 different languages. It's now in a sixth edition.
Wow.
And sold about 400,000 copies.
You, as you say, are into the sixth edition of The New Rules of Marketing and PR. What has changed, do you think, in recent years?
What continually changes over each of the editions, and I write a new edition approximately every 2 years. So when the first edition came out, as I was writing the book in 2005 and 2006, Facebook was only for students. Twitter didn't exist. The largest social media by volume was MySpace. With each edition, there are new tools. The recent edition that's just out now, I have a big section on Facebook Live, for example. What's fascinating, though, is the strategies have not changed. So what I wrote about that originally came out way back in 2007 was that the old rules were that you had three ways to generate attention. One way is that you could buy advertising. Advertising in, for example, newspapers, magazine, television, radio stations, billboards. You could buy a mailing list either online or offline and send people things. That's one way to generate attention. Another way to generate attention is to do traditional public relations and try to convince the media to write about you or broadcast about you. And the third way to generate attention is to do selling in one form or another. Have a storefront with salespeople in it, or do cold calling, or whatever it might be. And then the new rules of marketing and PR are that you can earn attention by creating excellent content that reaches people at the moment that they're looking for a product or service that you offer. Mm-hmm. And that strategy has not changed at all in 10 years. It still works. It's still valid. There's nuances that have changed, but the strategy itself hasn't changed.
So what about the issue of content overload, though? I mean, it's a lot harder now than it was a decade ago to be heard online.
I believe that to be true. However, I think that if, number one, you're creating content truly of value for the people you're trying to reach, if you're really clever at understanding the people you're trying to reach, your buyer personas, then you can create the content which will be valuable for them. You use the words and phrases they use. You focus your content on the problems that they face. And that's different than 99% of the companies out there that, you know, they hear about this idea of creating content, so they create stuff about their products and services.
Right.
And that's not as effective. The second perspective is that most of us, me included, are in a niche business. Mm-hmm. You know, I would imagine most people who are listening in right now, you know, aren't selling a commodity product like toilet paper, but they're selling and marketing a niche product of some sort. And in my experience, in practically every niche, there is room for somebody to create content that will find an audience, because people are self-selecting themselves into small niches. So I just think the first thing that came to mind is I'm a surfer. And whenever I go to Nantucket Island to go surfing, I go to a particular beach, and there's a surf school there. And it's Nantucket Island Surf School. Mm-hmm. And the owner of that business, Gary Kohner, is really great at using Instagram. So his whole thing is that he reaches his existing and potential customers through his Instagram feed, which is his feed ID is Nantucket Surfing. And so what this does, number one, if you go to his surf school, or if you just happen to be in the water when he's giving lessons, you might end up with a really cool photograph of yourself, because he takes photos in the water, he takes photos from the beach, and then he puts them on his Instagram. And then that serves as his marketing, because anybody who is planning on going to Nantucket Island for a vacation will then, you know, hey, what can we do in Nantucket? Oh, wow, surfing, that might be a good idea. And if they enter Nantucket Surfing, he pops up number one.
Right.
And so that's an incredible niche. I mean, you know, you think about Nantucket Island Surfing, and there are other people who are in the surfing business on Nantucket Island. There's several surf shops, and there's several other surf instructors, but he's the one that pops up first, because he's managed to do the best content in that one niche.
Right. But when I think about other niches, well, let's just take the world that you and I live in, marketing. There are so many people out there writing about marketing, talking about marketing. Do you think it's better to niche down then by a particular type of audience or by an industry? How do you determine what is the right way to make that niche choice?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So I think, first of all, if it's just plain old marketing, that's a pretty big market. And I would think that would be difficult to break through.
Sure.
However, it could be a niche based on a type of marketing. It could be a niche based on marketing in a particular city. It could be a niche based on marketing of in a particular industry. And I've seen people who have done well creating content in all of those areas. Now, I'll give you an example of something that I did that worked brilliantly. Mm-hmm. Is about, I guess about 6 or 7 years ago, I kind of hit on this idea of what I called real-time marketing.
Yeah.
And the idea of real-time marketing is that when the moment is right, if you're in front of people with a piece of content, that you can frequently use that to your advantage. Mm-hmm. The time that I was thinking long and hard about this idea of real-time marketing, Google changed its algorithm so that it was indexing blog posts in real time.
Yeah.
And then that gave, that was a real strong example of what real-time marketing is, because you used to have to wait. I mean, I've been writing my blog since 2004, and I remember in the early days, you wrote a blog post, and it would take 6 weeks for it to get indexed by Google.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, and then it became instantaneous. So I started writing about the ideas of real-time marketing. I don't know that I coined the phrase real-time marketing, but I was certainly the first person to write a book about real-time marketing, and I was the first person to really talk a lot about real-time marketing. And I'm going to check now while we're on the phone. but I have normally been the number one hit on Google for real-time marketing. So that's an example of taking a very new concept and then creating content around it.
Yeah.
And having that come up as, so I'm not number one any longer, but I'm very close to being number one for the phrase real-time marketing.
Yeah.
Another example in my own world is that I found something that people were doing and then named it. So that's newsjacking.
Yeah, and I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, and newsjacking is awesome. So essentially the way newsjacking works is that when a news story is breaking, that you can create a piece of content around that news story based on your area of expertise, mm-hmm. and then put that out at the moment that people are looking for more information on that. Both journalists are looking for somebody to quote, and also consumers are looking for someone who they might be able to do business with around that particular area.
Yeah.
So I named this concept of newsjacking. And then I got the URL newsjacking.com.
Mm-hmm.
I created an online course called Master Newsjacking, and you know, really just focused on writing articles and creating content around the concept of newsjacking. When I first wrote about it, people were like, "What the heck is that?" and I just did a little search while we were talking. I'm number one for that phrase, for that word newsjacking,
right.
on Google, but also there's 131,000 hits. So this idea that I named something that already existed,
mm-hmm.
and then worked my butt off to get that name commonly used in the marketplace,
yeah.
Resulted in me being the number one person in the world for that concept.
Yeah.
Even what I could have done was trademark it. I could have said, no, nobody else is allowed to use this word. It's my word. I didn't. I kept it totally open, which was a great decision, because there's many, many, many people who are writing about newsjacking, and most but not all of them will refer back to me.
That's right. And then if people look up the term, you're still, because you were the first and you wrote a lot about it, you're still going to show up right at the top.
Exactly. And also because I have the URL newsjacking.com. So yeah, so I'm still popping up there. And then that drives people into my work. It drives people to then say, well, this newsjacking concept's pretty neat. Maybe I should subscribe to David's online program, which is $450 to learn about newsjacking. Or it's a chapter in my New Rules of Marketing PR book, so people can learn about it there. And then sometimes people will say, hey, we want you to come speak at our conference about newsjacking.
Yeah.
And I use the technique myself frequently. So the most recent huge example of it was I frequently had written about Donald Trump's marketing because not from a perspective of politics, not from a perspective of me being a supporter of Donald Trump's, but simply because I felt Donald Trump, when he was not as president, but when he was a candidate, had the best marketing of the different candidates, both the other Republicans who ran in the primary as well as the general election with Hillary Clinton, because he was the most real-time candidate. Now, again, there's a concept I pioneered, real-time marketing, and he also engaged in newsjacking, because when something was happening in the news, he would comment on it. So Donald Trump was a newsjacking master. And I wrote about that a number of times on my blog, that Donald Trump was the most real-time marketing candidate, and Donald Trump was the one that was doing newsjacking more. And wrote about that a number of times. I did a video with Tony Robbins of he and I discussing this concept on a video. It got something like 200,000 views on YouTube. And so I became known as somebody who was doing a pretty good job at analyzing Donald Trump's marketing. That got me quoted in dozens and dozens of news stories, and directly led to speaking engagements. And I charge more than $20,000 for a speaking engagement. So for me, the idea of analyzing Donald Trump's marketing from the perspective of the concepts of marketing that I pioneered of real-time marketing and newsjacking was incredibly powerful for my personal brand. And I think...
Yeah.
I think there is still room for people to do that in marketing. I think that anybody listening in, if they're in a niche where, for example, they're in marketing, they're in customer service, they're in public relations or sales or consulting or some very broad concept, can still identify a niche, name that niche, work like crazy to publicize that niche, and then can be known as being the pioneer of that niche in a way that will drive business.
Yeah, it's creating your own market. It's sort of like Volvo being the first car brand to focus on safety.
On safety, yeah. I think that's right. And I think even though you're absolutely right that there is a lot of content out there, it's not as, and I would freely admit it's not as easy as it used to be. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely convinced that it's absolutely possible for any organization to figure it out in such a way, or any individual to figure it out in such a way that they can, their content can be the winner.
So what about the risks of newsjacking? We've seen a lot of people, since you pioneered that technique or wrote about that technique, there have been a lot of companies that have tried to do it and been burned because they did it badly.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
In nearly every case of newsjacking gone bad, it's gone bad because the people or the organization that were doing the newsjacking did one of several things. Number one, they chose a story that had a very negative connotation.
Right.
So death and destruction is not a very good idea to try to do a newsjack.
Yeah.
The second thing that people have sometimes done that have gotten them in trouble through social networks, where people have called them out, is they've tried to newsjack a story that they do not have a legitimate tie to. By a legitimate tie, I mean that your area of expertise is not focused in any way on the story that you attempted to tie your brand to. So.
Yeah.
You know, classic of to that is American Apparel. You know, said, "Hey, there's," and combining these two things I just talked about. Hurricane Sandy is coming. If you live on the East Coast, you can take 20% off your next order, which is, you know, just kind of crazy on a number of levels.
Although from their perspective, they would say, "Well, we're offering something of value to people who are going to need to buy new stuff."
From their perspective, perhaps they did. However, it was seen as being exploitative of a natural disaster that killed 50 people and left millions without power and tens of thousands of people homeless.
Right.
And that's what people remembered about that, was that it just was seen as being self-serving as opposed to being helpful. But I would contrast that with Duracell, the battery company, and they have a program called Power Forward, where they airdrop, in the case of Puerto Rico, is airdropped trucks that drive around and deliver free batteries to people affected by natural disasters. And
wow.
So number one, they do have a tie to the story, because when natural disaster happens, power typically goes out, and they're a company that provides power in the form of batteries. And number two, they weren't trying to sell batteries.
They were
giving them away.
Yeah, I think
that was seen as valuable, and they have hundreds of thousands of people who comment on their Facebook, and millions of people who like them on Facebook as a result of their being generous. In Puerto Rico, there was a major hurricane, or I think it was Irma recently. They gave away 700,000 batteries. It's a lot of batteries. It was 30 tons of batteries that they airlifted into Puerto Rico. So, I mean, it's a serious effort, and they're seen as being very, that is seen as very positive by people.
For sure. And I think that's something that we see a lot more now, is organizations, you know, not just as cynical PR ploys, but obviously there is part of that to it, using major, major charitable work as a marketing tool, basically.
Yes.
Not, you know, as I say, not to imply that they're being cynical about it, because they are doing good.
And I think that is right, that something like this, I think it's really difficult to see the cynicism, because it's a major, major effort.
Yeah. I know we're running tight on time. There were a couple of questions I did want to ask you. I was sort of reading back over some of your stuff. And one of the arguments you had made some time ago was that when you're providing content, it should not be gated, even to the extent of asking for an email address, which is something that I agreed with for a long time. And yet there is so much data that suggests that you should be getting that email address. Do you still feel that ungated content is the way to go?
I think that, first of all, I don't think it's as cut and dry as either or. However, I do think people tend to put gates on it way too quickly. So I see it as free content is a gift. Yep. And people appreciate getting gifts, and people share gifts with others. So if your content is free, you're likely to get other people who share it, and that's likely to help to increase your search engine results. Yeah. However, when you put a gate on content, or you require an email for people to see it, you're setting up an adversarial relationship with people before you even have a chance to know who they are, because you're saying, okay, I'm going to give you something, but you can't have it unless you give me something first. Mm-hmm. That's an adversarial relationship you're setting up. So I think that free content is best as the first form of content that you provide for somebody. But I think it's totally cool and, in fact, preferable to have a hybrid model where the first bit of content is completely free. So you give away a white paper or an ebook or an infographic or something completely for free with no registration required whatsoever. And then within that free content is a secondary offer for something else of value. But on that secondary offer, you can certainly require an email address. So what that does is it spreads your ideas far and wide with the free content. And then it also provides an opportunity for anybody who has already consumed the free content and enjoys what you're doing to be able to ask for something more. And then you have an opportunity to know who they are. Now, when you get that secondary offered email address, it's even more valuable for you, because all of the people who want the original white paper and give you an email address, those are just people who express interest in your white paper without having read it before. But if you have a secondary offer inside of a white paper, and they read your entire white paper and they say, well, shoot, I want to know more, and then there's an offer to attend a webinar or an offer for a free consultation or whatever it might be, then those are people who are truly interested, because they've already gone through the process of reading your paper. So I'm a fan of that kind of approach. I also think what could work is having multiple offers. So you can have a bunch of free content, but occasionally have some that's behind a gate. So a bunch of free content and then a webinar. Is an approach that works. I am dead set against, though, people who, you know, put gates behind everything, and their entire marketing strategy is around this adversarial relationship of, here, I'll give you something, but I won't, you're not allowed to have it unless you give me something first.
So why do you think that, I mean, we know that the adversarial thing is not a good way to market. We know that interruption advertising is not a good way to market. And yet, if anything, I'm seeing more interruption advertising happening than ever before. Why is that? Is it just that people lack creativity, or what?
There's a lot of reasons for it, but I think one of the main reasons is that's how it's always been done. It's how it's still taught in school. It's how the bosses that run marketing departments and agencies learned how to do it. The requirement of an email address for a white paper is a holdover from the direct mail days. I'm old enough to remember when we used to have white paper offers that were sent through the mail, a postal mail, and then it had a BRC, a business reply card. And you would fill out your business reply card, and then we would mail you the white paper. You know, that was in the early 90s, and that technique of delivering white papers was then transformed by, you know, thousands of marketers to the web, and they just did the exact same thing, except they did it on the web, which was, okay, well, we're going to offer a white paper, but now you fill out the form on the web rather than sending in the business reply card. And so it was and still is people who are using the techniques that worked in an offline world to generate attention in an online world, and they're not willing or willing to recognize the differences that that online world allows.
One final question for you, because I know you're on a time limit here. What do you see as being the biggest trends or changes going forward? What's changing, do you think, in, say, the next couple of years that will really shake up what we're doing in terms of marketing and PR?
The two things that I see that that are on my radar, number one is artificial intelligence. And yeah. I think that AI, I mean, AI is already in marketing, but I think AI has potential to be much bigger in marketing in the future. And I think that all of us need to begin to understand what it means for us to have this kind of approach to marketing. You know, for example, artificial intelligence can look at every blog post you've written and help you to figure out which blog posts that you should be writing in the future and maybe what that headline should be. So there's all sorts of things that artificial intelligence can do. The other thing is, what, if anything, will blockchain allow us to do differently, and how will that affect marketing? Like, I see potential in the future for the current big aggregators of content to be disintermediated with blockchain. So, for example, I see a world, I mean, maybe it's not a couple of years, which was your question, but maybe it's 20 years, where companies like Facebook and Google no longer control the ways that people interact with advertising. and rather every person on the web through blockchain can control what they're looking at in such a way that they can almost offer bidding for people to generate attention through them. And so,
can you explain that? How would that work?
Well, you might say, okay, I'm going to be working, I'm going to be, I'm interested in buying a new car, and you can register that interest in some way, and then people can bid for your attention. And there's all sorts of things to try to figure out how to make it work. But essentially, rather than going to a central database, which is Google or Facebook, you end up being able to transact with individual advertisers who show you advertising. And that's the way that Bitcoin works now, but for money. So rather than going to a bank as the central place where a financial transaction happens, like if I buy something from a company, there has to be a bank in the middle of that. Whether it's a credit card or however I pay, PayPal, whatever it is, there's a bank in the middle of that. What Bitcoin and other blockchain cryptocurrency technologies allow is for that transaction to happen between two people with no bank in the middle of it. So the same thing is possible with things like advertising. And that if that ends up playing out like it's possible that it could, it has a potential to completely upend the way marketing is done.
Exciting, exciting times. Is there anything you wish I'd asked you that I haven't?
No, I think you've done a great job. However, I would add one final thought, and that is that marketing should be fun. You know, the sorts of things that we've been talking about for the last half hour, this is fun stuff. And if you think marketing is a drag and it's kind of like part of what you have to do, and, you know, try to figure out what it is you do like and how you can make that a part of the kind of approaches that we've been talking about. I'll refer back to Gary Kohner from Nantucket Island Surf School. He always thought marketing was dreadful and never liked it until he recognized that he loves to take photos. And so Instagram was perfect for him. And he built his entire business on the back of Instagram because he loves to take photos. He's technically inclined. He's happy to take the photos, manipulate them, put them on his Instagram. And that's been extremely helpful for his business. So marketing is fun. Try to figure out for you personally how you can make it fun.
Yeah, for me, it's interviewing people. I love it.
Yeah, there you go. You've found a nice niche here of doing this kind of discussion, and that serves as marketing for you.
Yeah, absolutely. But I keep thinking I really ought to do video, and I'm just not comfortable with it. Yeah. I love getting in front of a live audience to speak, but video, whole other matter.
There you go. Well, that's it. That's just the point. You do what is comfortable for you.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much for your time, David. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Tamara. Thank you very much.
This has already been a pretty long episode, so I won't spend more time with the recap. Before I do go, though, I want to thank ATB for its sponsorship of the Alberta Podcast Network and, indirectly, for its sponsorship of this podcast. Did you know that ATB has an Entrepreneur Center? If you're starting or building a business, their Entrepreneur Center is actually a great place to check out. I mean, of course, they can help you with your banking, which of course is what they want to do, but they also have a ton of free workshops and networking opportunities. They can even help you get set up with a mentor. And if you're looking for more business podcasts to learn from, you might want to check out fellow Alberta Podcast member Louisa Campos's podcast, A Branded World. You can explore all the Alberta Podcast Network podcasts at albertapodcastnetwork.com. That's it for me for today. If you notice that my voice was perhaps a little more Marlena Dietrich than normal, it's thanks to the cold I've had that's been lingering for 2 weeks now. Hopefully, by the time of our next episode, I will be completely back to health. And so will you for the tons and tons and tons of people out there who seem to have colds or flus right now. Have a wonderful couple of weeks.